Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you non-monetized, endorsement-free insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, in episode 139, I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Chow and Dr. M. Ali Khan. This is a Journal Club episode we recorded actually before the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting, but we decided to hold it given the surplus of episodes at the time. We discussed three major articles examining K-Grant awardees in ophthalmology, patient education available online for retinal detachment, and ophthalmology organizational support for medical students and trainees. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by two retina specialists for this Journal Club. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Daniel Chow from the University of California, San Diego. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay, for having me again.
And then Dr. M. Ali Khan from the University of California, Los Angeles, part of the Doheny Eye Institute. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be back.
So we're going to quick hit three recent articles from JAMA Ophthalmology, all of which are kind of related more to education, patient education, and then, you know, advancement in career. So we're going to start off with, and these are all kind of shorter reports that hopefully will inspire some discussion. We're going to start off with Dan Chow's article, which unintentionally I picked, and then Dan pointed out he helped write this. So it's great. He's on the podcast to help talk about this. This is called Success in Attaining Independent Funding Among National Institutes of Health K-Grant Awardees in Ophthalmology. I'm going to mess up the primary author's name. Protopsaltis is the primary author. Dr. Dan Chow was the senior author along with Dr. Stephen Getty. Ali, to risk the bias, Dan's going to infuse by telling us how great his article is. Tell us a little bit about this article.
Yeah, so this was actually a follow-up study of a prior article by this same group, and they looked at people who have been awarded a KOH or K23 Career Development Award from the NIH and tracked how many of those people ultimately went on to gain a R01 or U10 grant, which are considered kind of an independent research program significant enough to receive, you know, a good amount of funding from the NIH. And their previous report showed that the number of ophthalmologists who got a K award and then ultimately got a larger, say, R01 award is actually quite small. But on a follow-up study, they found that a lot more of those people had ultimately obtained the award, but years later. So the average amount of years after their K award lapsed, which is usually a five-year award, was 3 years or so afterwards. But, you know, they went into sort of some of the characteristics of the people who did or did not get the awards. But it looks like the percentage of patients who, or percentage of ophthalmologists who get a K award who ultimately do get an R01 award was higher than they previously reported.
Dan, your comments.
Yeah, no, I think that was a great summary. Ali should have written the paper. It would have been a lot shorter that way. But just to take a little bit of a step back for those that are like not, this is somewhat of a very kind of a niche subject. So it kind of goes along with individuals in ophthalmology who are really interested in spending a significant amount of time doing research along with clinical care. So I think when we're all, I think as I think all three of us are at academic institutions, so we're reviewing ophthalmology residency applications, and everyone gets really excited about ophthalmology, and they all say, I'm going to do like academics and do research and teaching and everything like that. But then one of the things is, you know, how many people end up on the other end actually spend a significant amount of time doing research. And usually to do this, most people will, after you finish your residency and fellowship and you've decided, I really want to be at an academic institution and I also want to spend, you know, a significant amount of my time, maybe about, you know, between 50% and 75% doing some kind of research, whether that be clinical research or laboratory research. And then generally the path for these individuals, which is a just fairly small minority, is to apply for one of these K grants. So what are K grants? K grants are, they're usually 5 years and they provide 75% of your salary support to essentially be mentored by a group or an institution to develop an independent research program. So the goal is at the end of the 5 years, you will have been, you know, trained and be able to independently run your own research program. And the idea is for you to get one of these R01 grants, which are, it's kind of a benchmark for funding at the NIH, which also provides 5 years of funding. And so, you know, I was curious because this is a path that I'm interested in. So, you know, how well do these people do? Like, how many end up getting R01s? And I think Ali very eloquently described that, the results of the paper.
So, Dan, so you guys looked at people who got a K award from 1996 to 2017, and it looked like there was 128 people who got a K award. And of those, about half, like 62, ended up getting an R01 or U10. So about half of the people who get these early career development awards ultimately get the larger, quote unquote, primary investigator awards later. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
So 50%. 50% is not bad, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I would say it's actually pretty good. So, you know, I think as probably a lot of you know, it's, you know, the funding climate for the NIH is actually extremely competitive with more people applying and less funds being available. And so if we benchmark, say, so the National Eye Institute isn't the only NIH institute that has these K grants. All of the major institutes do. And one thing we looked at was to try to benchmark ophthalmology K grants versus, say, those in other institutes like the National Cancer Institute. And there's not a lot of data, but it seems like, you know, in general, ophthalmologists, you know, this is at least average or above average for most K awardees in terms of the conversion rate from a K08 award to an R01. I would say it's probably a little bit on the higher side. And so I think that there's something to be commended about the people who decide to pursue this career path. And I think also, the National Eye Institute also deserves a lot of commendation to, you know, prioritizing this funding for this support mechanism and really appreciating the importance of these career development awards, because they're really one of the only ways that that these ophthalmologists can get the protected time that they need to develop into researchers. And so I think the National Eye Institute has, you know, made it a priority to keep funding this program despite the flat amount of money that's actually going to the NIH.
You know, it's interesting that one of the things you guys addressed in your discussion was that, and I think this is in contrast to a lot of the negativity we hear about NIH and public funding. You referenced that the NIH budget has been good, the awards have increased, and though there is some fluctuation, that it's overall, like you said, a positive trend. The results of this study, as Ali referenced, are overall positive. You know, so this is nice because I do think maybe there's some selection bias in terms of the people who end up, you know, plugging through and getting through and maybe not leaving the academic field, but it's not as dire as people make it out to be. I mean, that's what I would feel after reading this. I think that there's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of pessimism about going this route when you consider this, or when any of us enter the academic realm. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
Go ahead, Ali.
You go ahead, Dan. You're the MD, PhD, and author of this article, so
Yeah, but his PhD does not help him, according to their results. PhD does not help you get an R01.
It did not help me, Ali. I should have saved those 5 years of my life. I think we were surprised when we found this. We were actually, you know, glad that this happened, that, you know, I think for me personally, like, hey, okay, people end up doing okay in the end. And I should just say, you know, part of it, I think, is that we just, if you look at the sheer numbers of people, let's just take retina, for instance, we categorize them by different groups. But if you just look at the last group from 2011 to 2017, I believe there were 28 people that we categorized as retina. That could either be surgical retina, medical retina, which if you break it down by years, it's 4 people per year. And when you think about all of the, say, applicants for retina fellowships, both surgical and medical, let's say there's about 100 surgical applicants, I don't know, maybe 30 to 50 medical retinas. So out of a group of about 150 people who are going into retina, 4 of them are actually, you know, receiving these K grants, which is, you know, you're looking at 3% of the whole population. And so I would advocate that we need more people to do this career path to really push the field forward. Of course, there's a lot of reasons that people don't go into that, and I think they're fairly obvious. I think one is just the, first the academics versus private practice. There's obviously the large pay differential, but I think when you decide to pursue the what's called kind of the classic like clinician scientist track, is that you really are doing two jobs at once, and it's very challenging and very difficult. I can share kind of my own travails and struggles. It's very difficult because it's literally two full-time jobs in one. And I think, if you talk to anyone on that group, those 28 people, I think the story is very similar, that I think what keeps them going is that they feel like they really want to, contribute to ophthalmologists in this way. They feel like they can do it and they're in the right environment to do it. And they decide to plug away despite all of the, multiple grant rejections, the difficulties in terms of managing both the research and clinical time, and also the kind of lack of financial compensation. But I would really argue that we need more people. When you think about all of the bright minds that are going into retina and ophthalmology, it would be great to be able to try and harness more of those to really create the next innovations that are needed.
Well, Ali, I don't know if you have any final thoughts before we switch topics.
No, yeah, I think a lot of what Dan said is probably true for a lot of people, the kind of two full-time jobs in one. I think another thing is that, like Dan mentioned, I think 70 to 80% of your time is protected for research, so that you actually you're not allowed to do clinical activities during those things if they're not related to your actual research project. So I think it is tough for people who are still very interested in being busy clinically and doing surgery and, still seeing patients, I think, to stomach that a little bit, to be saying, okay, now I only have, 20% of my time to sort of do this. And, I think personally, that's hard for me. It would be hard for me to sort of kind of think of myself only doing research, given kind of the training that we have and what I personally enjoy. So I think, it seems like it's an all or nothing type of situation, that I think if there was an in between, I think more people would maybe be a little bit more interested in doing it. And, private practice now does a lot of research, primarily clinical. And I think, you can make headway in that environment as well. So I think, that's another reason why we may not see as many people applying for these as we might expect just by numbers. But luckily, it seems like the people who do and are making it through are ultimately getting success in terms of future funding. So at least I took that as a positive.
Well, we're going to roll it back with our next article to earlier in your career. So
Jay, can I just comment on one last thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I completely agree with all of Ali's comments in terms of, I think that's one downside, is that the NIH mandates that you're spending 75% of your time on research. And I think for those that want to do laboratory research, that makes sense, and they make that distinction at least early on in their careers until that K award finishes. But I would say there's a lot of people who have been able to balance both having a clinically busy practice as well as doing a K grant. And usually these are due the K23 grants, which are the more clinically oriented ones. And I think one great example would be Justice Ehlers, who did the K23 using intraoperative OCT. So when you're able to merge your clinical, that your research is going on in your clinic, then in some ways you can have the best of both worlds. So just to note that there are, that there's multiple ways to do it, to try and satisfy both your clinical and research needs.
Perfect. Well, rolling it back to a simpler time when you guys talking about K grants and R01 grants, and my head's just spinning. And I want to talk about medical students and residents. So next topic is educational and scholarly opportunities for medical students and residents, professional ophthalmology organizations, published September 20th, 2018, as a research letter in JAMA Ophthalmology, Yang et al. Dan, you want to tell us a little bit about what they did here? It's a very short kind of report, and then we'll talk about implications.
Yeah, so this was an interesting report. I think the main question they wanted to ask were, what are the opportunities for medical students in some of these professional ophthalmology organizations. And the idea is, let's see how, you know, if perhaps these organizations such as the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the Retina Society, et cetera, were more like open and willing to medical students, perhaps more medical students would go into ophthalmology. So what they did was they surveyed 17 professional organizations. These included the AAO, essentially most of the like different subspecialty societies. They looked whether they offered membership to medical students, what the cost was, whether medical students were able to present at their meeting, to be able to serve on committees, whether they were able to vote, and also were there any differences in the cost of the registration for medical students versus, say, residents. And so there were 17 such groups, and what they found was that it looks like about 24% of them offered membership to medical students. Most of the conference fees were fairly similar to residents. Of note, many of the organizations, the medical students were allowed to present research at the meeting, but there were only two groups, ARVO, as well as the OOSS, which is the Outpatient Ophthalmic Surgery Society, that actually allowed medical students to serve on the committees. And I think this was pretty similar to residents for the most part, except for, you know, there were certain things that residents may have had a slightly higher membership fee for some of these organizations.
Ollie, initial thoughts before I chime in?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it actually kind of, you know, the percentage of these organizations, I think there were 17 or so listed on there that included sort of medical students or residents in a more formal fashion, whether it's membership or leadership, was low. Overall, I guess you could say, especially for the medical students, I think it was like 24% of them offered membership, while the residents, it was higher than 50%. So, you know, I do remember being a med student and sort of wanting to get involved and sort of looking for opportunities. And then you kind of hear about these national organizations, but the actual experience you had wasn't so meaningful. It almost felt like it was just something you could maybe write on your CV or something, but you didn't really do too much. And I think, you know, that's something that requires work on both ends, meaning medical students maybe being more serious about the commitment, but also these organizations making a more meaningful experience available for younger trainees. So, you know, I could see it from both sides. I think it's, you know, maybe these organizations say, oh, med students aren't serious and can't really do too much in these organizations, so let's sort of not include them. And then on the flip side, you know, medical students are saying, hey, we need more education in ophthalmology and more sort of meaningful experience because we're not getting it in med school. So we need something, but, you know, we're not getting it from you. So it's sort of the chicken and the egg argument here.
You know, I think for me, the most interesting part of all of this is cost. And this is something we've referenced before, but whether you're a resident or a medical student, especially if you're a medical student where you really have no income, you have negative income a lot of times from your tuition via loans or whatever you're paying for your medical school tuition. And there really aren't a ton of grants or awards or travel grants or fellowships available for medical students. So, and I've run into this issue with medical students I mentor where, you know, I've tried to get money that I've gotten from donations and things like that to set aside so they can go to these meetings, because these meetings are exorbitantly expensive sometimes. And I like that the costs are less for medical students and residents than they are for the non-member ophthalmologists who may want to attend. But it would be really nice if more of these meetings could offer either some sort of award or grant or even just waiving the fee for students. We want to really kind of, A, give them a platform to present their research, but B, also foster mentorship, foster collaboration, get people interested in the field. I mean, I remember as a resident going to ASRS as a third year, and that was like a really nice opportunity. That really got me excited to become a retina doctor. And I think that that's a very formative time, whether you're a resident or a medical student. I think the more we can get them in the room and, you know, at the very least seeing what's going on, and even better if they're presenting, the better it's going to be for the future of our field.
Yeah, I think maybe less of an issue for residents who are maybe, you know, already decided they're going into this field, they chose it for a reason and maybe are looking, you know, I was at that ASRS meeting with you, Jay, back then. We were kind of applying for fellowship,
right.
So we were kind of excited, you know, learning about meeting everybody on the trail and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, that's a different group, residents versus medical students, in my view. I think, you know, for UCLA, you know, I was a UCLA med student, now I'm faculty at UCLA. They were pretty generous about if you're a medical student and willing to go to these meetings and present, they would fund you. So I was able to go to a couple of meetings as a student because of that, say, like, you know, for example, ARVO. You know, maybe not all schools are like that. And I don't know how it is at University of Miami or UCSD where you two are at. But at UCLA, you know, the curriculum has changed quite a bit, where the ophthalmology education is no longer really focused on what an ophthalmologist would know, but rather more what a, you know, a general medical graduate, say, in internal medicine would know, you know, once they graduate, assuming that, you know, they're not interested in ophthalmology, aren't really going to take time to go into, you know, using a direct ophthalmoscope, but, you know, just knowing the basics. And I think that maybe turned some people off to looking into the field. So, you know, maybe some of these professional organizations do need to do a little bit more to kind of counteract that. Because I do think you're attracted to fields that your school emphasizes or that your school is good at. And if we're sort of dumbing down ophthalmology education, I don't think that bodes well for people getting into it.
Well, before I let Dan go, you mean that ASRS meeting where I mistook our future assistant fellowship program director for a resident? Because if that's the meeting you're referring to, I don't know what you're talking about. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think this was a really interesting article, and then and particularly pertinent because as one of the hats that I wear at UCSD is actually I'm the director of medical student education. So it, you know, involves like, you know, how do we educate medical students who are not going into ophthalmology about ophthalmology? But I think also even more important, how do we foster and encourage interested medical students to enter ophthalmology? And I agree. I think one way to do that is for them to be able to go to some of these national meetings and see what it's really like. And I think for, you know, usually most of the students that I mentor, I highly encourage them to go to ARVO. I usually, if they do a project with me, at least try to pay for part of their registration there. But I think, you know, and I think that might be the best way to go in some ways, because I think of all the meetings, probably ARVO is the one that most medical students will go to, and perhaps having sections that are catered specifically to where other medical students who are going there, they can have like a special program just focused specifically on medical students would be helpful. I guess on the flip side, one aspect, unfortunately, of ophthalmology is that a lot of times medical students just don't have that much knowledge of the field just because they're not really exposed to it. So they don't necessarily appreciate all of the subtle aspects that may go into some of these other subspecialty meetings like Retina Society and other things, like where even second and third year residents, we don't really quite understand what's going on a lot of the time. So, but I agree. I think definitely perhaps more focused mechanisms or programs that really give medical students who are interested a great experience at some of these professional meetings would be great.
I just want to say I still don't know what's going on most of the time, so I know exactly what that feels like. You know, just last words on this topic, I think, before we move to the last article about patient education. I think that educating medical students, like you said, is extremely challenging. One of the things they've done at Bascom, which they didn't have when I was a student, but I think I maybe started a couple of years ago after I graduated from the University of Miami Medical School, is at least in the clinical blocks, they offer two different ophthalmology electives. And so one of the electives is specifically for people going into ophthalmology, and one of the electives is for people who are not going into ophthalmology. And they don't always manage to stratify it, but they generally try to stagger it. So, and I think that's helpful because that gears the lectures, that gears the discussion, that gears the sort of clinics and assignments they're given clinically. And so it is really nice. Now, that's not helpful for someone who's on the fence maybe, and it's a little late in the game because it's third year, but it's still better. And I think it's overall nice to do that because some people just want to see it if they're going to internal medicine or ER or neurology and get like a feel for the field. And making it more relevant and directed to them is probably helpful as they go forward in their careers. Because I think we'd all agree that overall, unfortunately, ophthalmology education of other physicians in other fields is not as good as it could be.
Ooh, are those rotations as a third year, Jay, or is that a fourth year?
So they're offered as elective third or fourth year. But I would say the majority of the non-ophthalmology people are taking it as fourth years, and the majority of the ophthalmology people take it as third years.
Gotcha. So it's almost self-selecting, you know? Like
right,
if you've already sort of decided, you know, it's kind of, that's the hard part. If you've already made a decision, I think those people are already interested, right? So you don't have to focus so much on that. you know, it's kind of the preclinical or, you know, even during your third year where you're actually deciding on what you want to do, that I think we need to sort of put our best foot forward in showing people what our field is about. Because, you know, I went into ophthalmology and made the decision, but I really didn't know what it was like until you become a resident, honestly. And I think, you know, and I went to a medical school with an absolutely, you know, top five ophthalmology program. So it's, you know, it's hard to get to know a field where you can't see what you're supposed to see and you don't know how to use the tools. It's like playing a sport without knowing the rules. So I think you have to give people a chance or else, you know, naturally you're going to gravitate to something that you would, that's a little bit easier to grasp. At least that's how I felt about it.
Fact check. I don't know about this, Ali. I mean, the Ophthalmology Times rankings, Jules Stein came in at a solid 10th in the best overall category. We know how scientific that is. So,
well, time has changed.
Is that also
graduated
with the Kenny Eye Institute as well to boost them up?
Yeah, they fell by merging, which makes no sense. Anyway, Dan, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry, that was off topic.
Another point on, like, I think that's an important topic in terms of how do we expose medical students to the field, because I think the most common, you know, I think for all the, we don't really know about ophthalmologists until we're introduced by ophthalmologists or just have a chance finding. And I think in terms of the curriculum at UC San Diego is that they get two workshops on direct ophthalmoscopy as a preclinical student, and then they have an opportunity on their surgery rotation to do a two-week selective in ophthalmology. And but they don't have any time during their third year to do a full elective, so it kind of depends on when your surgical surgery elective is. You know, one thing that I've done at UC San Diego is that we've actually started an elective in the preclinical years called Introduction to Ophthalmology. It's a very, like, informal course where essentially we set up two, like, shadowing sessions, like one in the clinic, one in the OR, and have a couple lectures, like, once a week on just different topics on ophthalmology. Nothing really, it's more to get people excited about ophthalmology. And I think it's just helped to, I think having something similar at places just helps the students to at least put it on the map. And, like, you know, you only need to go to one clinic or surgery to at least get a taste of, like, oh, this is something that's actually kind of interesting. Let me keep it in my differential when I'm on my third year. Because I think, again, the big issue is just exposure to ophthalmology.
Well, before we switch gears, I just want to say I was kidding when I mentioned the rankings to Ali. Very non-scientific rankings. 31% response rate from chairman and PD, and only 73 responses total to create those rankings. So just FYI, fact checking those rankings too.
Wills was number one, right?
In residency.
Yeah. Just clarifying there.
So you can't be that upset with the methodology. You got to pick your side, Ollie. All right. Yep. Now, Wills came in sixth, though, overall. No, this is a different ranking. This is Ophthalmology Times. You're talking about the Doximity rankings. So you can defend the Doximity rankings and poo-poo the Ophthalmology Times ranking. There, and you're not a hypocrite that way. Perfect. Last one, accuracy of freely available information about regmatized retinal detachment on the internet by Eva Nisnovich et al., October 4, 2018, JAMA Ophthalmology Research Letter. I will quickly summarize and we'll discuss. I mean, this is just looking at what information is available on websites patients may encounter when they look up regmatized retinal detachment online. They had three vitreoretinal surgeons who evaluated each of the sites with various questions they formed to evaluate the quality of the information, the completeness of the information. And then each site essentially got a score, and then they averaged their scores. There were no differences between the observers when they analyzed their results that were statistically significant. And basically, PubMed was kind of the gold standard, getting a score of 3 for every question with a maximum score of 51. And then just comparing the other sources, you know, the biggest thing was that Wikipedia was much worse than PubMed, but was significantly better than other sources such as Medicine.net, WebMD, you know, even iWiki, National Institute of Mayo Clinic. iWiki, interestingly enough, they said may not be as relevant to patients because it doesn't really have pictures. It's kind of dry. It doesn't have any general information because it's geared more towards eye providers maybe than towards patients. And they were just talking about how Wikipedia seems to have evolved and actually is a decent source based on this study, probably just because as people over time, it's become better regulated and information, even though it's free source, is better managed. I'll let Dan start. You know, Dan and Ali finish. Dan, just your impressions briefly on this paper and patient information and what patients read about detachments.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting. I think the main point that I came away with is that Wikipedia is just like an amazing movement and resource in general. Like when you think just in general about how much people, even myself, like if I don't know something about usually the first place that I will go up or the first place that Google will take me is Wikipedia. And I think, first of all, I'm just kind of impressed by the general accuracy of the information in general for such a large resource. And I think that, you know, you have to commend the people at Wikipedia for that. You know, I don't have any financial ties to it, but I have donated to Wikipedia because I just think it's just an amazing resource in that way. But I think this study validates at least, you know, that aspect, and that a lot, you know, and that's probably where most patients are going to go first too, right? It just shows up there. And the fact that, you know, most of the information is pretty reliable, you know, and perhaps even more so than some of the sites that are specifically designed to provide patient information is pretty interesting. I think the other point is that in some ways you do get what you pay for in some ways in terms of these three sites. So I think you can get a whole bunch of different things, some of it accurate, some of it not. And so I think finding ways to better educate our patients or to allow us to be the source of information or direct them to the correct places is also helpful as well.
Ali?
Yeah, I think kind of what Dan said, you know, patients are definitely looking online for information about whether it's a retinal detachment or any other condition that they might have. So kind of having to explain or sort of reroute a conversation on a patient who's sort of already looked things up can be sometimes painful depending on, you know, what information they got from elsewhere. And then other times it's really helpful because they kind of already know what's going on before you even talk to them. I do think it's interesting that something like Wikipedia was better than, say, a resource like iWiki, which is technically supposed to be written by ophthalmologists. But as the paper says, maybe that's the problem. You know, it's sort of meant for people who have a bit more knowledge about ophthalmology in general, so maybe doesn't apply to patients. So I think it's these kind of articles are interesting because, you know, as more and more patients use, you know, online resources or even social media to kind of get information, I think we as a field need to sort of make sure what's out there is actually correct. And, you know, sometimes going back to the other article, the kind of the professional societies, I know the ASRS has patient resources and things listed on their website, but patients probably never get to those websites just because they don't know that that's a place you can go. So maybe, you know, the sources that ophthalmologists are actually making for patients, if we can get those out there better, maybe we can go from Wikipedia to these other sources rather than kind of the sources that don't give much information at all. So just, I think, a good kind of food for thought article.
There could be a way that we can also direct some of this information as well. Like, for instance, say a patient sees you for, let's say, an epiretinal membrane or something like that, is if there are some consensus sources that we as retina specialists can then direct them to, say, like the ASRS website, or we have them printed out. And so if they've already developed a rapport, they may trust, you know, the reliability of our recommendation more than others, and then help to kind of build that that education on our end as well, rather than, you know, leaving them to Google and find whatever they want on the internet.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that the more control we have over the information, the better. The other thing I've noticed, I don't know if you guys, this is a little off topic, but in a similar vein, I've modified my consent for certain procedures, assuming that a lot of patients are going to read. So, for example, when I talk about detachments, even if I see the detachment, I'm like, okay, you know, I'm going to do a buccal or a vitrectomy for this case. I always go through the different options, including pneumatic. And I'll say, just for completeness sake, I'll be like, I'm going to mention these different options. I'll explain why I don't think it's a good option, or I do think it's a good option. And I mentioned, like, in case you read, you might see something about this, you might see something about this. And it makes the consent process maybe a few seconds longer. But I feel like it helps with patient confidence because, you know, there's nothing worse than the patient leaves and then they read and they're like, well, he didn't mention anything about this, this, and this. And so I've actually, for certain things, or even for like a vitreoretinal macular traction, I always mention ochroplasmin in my discussion because they may come across it when they're reading, even if I'm not planning on using it. I generally don't use that medication. And I don't know if you guys have found similar things, but I feel like that's helpful because when I started, I didn't really realize that. And as I've gone along, I've incorporated things I think they may run into when they're looking things up.
Yeah, Jay, I completely agree with that. I just think for my own or our, you know, people that we know, like our experience with other medical procedures that we're not personally familiar with, like say if we need a orthopedic surgery or something like that, we even as trained, we've been to medical school, we've heard about orthopedic surgery, but we're going to do the exact same thing as patients. We're going to Google online, and it's probably going to be Wikipedia or WebMD that we're going to see, oh, hey, what's this thing? You know, my doctor never mentioned this. Is he actually a good doctor? Is he practicing, outdated? And so I think in terms of setting up that patient rapport, being able to mention all the possibilities that are out there, I think gives you credibility. Like, for instance, patient comes in with floaters and says, is there anything that you can do about it? And even though if you may not believe in treatments like vitrectomy or YAG laser, I think just mentioning to the patient that those are, possible treatments and maybe something that you do or do not recommend, I think, as a patient, that would definitely give a lot more credibility to the physician that way.
Ali, any final thoughts?
No, I think you guys kind of covered everything. I think each patient's sort of different. Kind of maybe my older patients, I don't know if it's just my practice, maybe don't want to know as much as to just tell me what you would do. And then the younger patients who I think have grown up kind of like us with, readily available Google search, et cetera, they do want to know more. So I kind of tailored a discussion based on how much I think the patient really wants to go through the full discussion. But I think we're going to need to do more and more of that as, people our age get older and actually get some of these conditions that we treat, because we're used to looking things up. And that's going to take a lot of time in the chair. So if we can do something to kind of streamline that and make the education process a little bit better, maybe through our professional societies or elsewhere, I think that would be that'd be helpful. Because if we're some of the private practices that we've encountered, you only get a certain number of minutes in the room, and you can't always do that with some of these full discussions. So getting better information out there is never a bad idea.
Yeah, I think Ali basically just said the millennial generation is a pain in the you know what.
Not necessarily. Well, we're part of it, so I don't think we could say we're.
I know. We're all complicit.
Yeah, I do think it's not just like a generational thing. It's just, if you know how to look stuff up, you're going to do it. So if more and more people are able to do that easily, just on their phone in the room, we have to sort of be ready to kind of discuss that. And you don't always want to, and it takes a lot more time, I think, to go through every single option, which is not going to be good for them. But if that's part of the game now, I think if we can get better information out there so that patients aren't as confused with the misinformation or incomplete information out there, I think it's going to just help us later on.
Well, you ruined my beautiful segue, because I was going to say, who else is a pain in the U.S. is Dwight Howard. And Dan is a Wizards fan, and Ali has had the pleasurable experience having Dwight Howard on his basketball team. So I'm going to end by Ali, fill in Dan on the Dwight Howard experience and what he can expect this year.
I wouldn't expect too much, Dan. And it was a short-lived and ill-fated tenure as a Laker. So we generally forget about that time. So I would say good luck, but don't expect too much.
I've written off the Wizards at this point.
They haven't even started the season.
Yeah.
It's not even October 16th yet. We're recording this in advance. Did you write off those Redskins as well? Are you done?
They go back and forth. I like Alex Smith as a choice, but they just seem too inconsistent to be a serious threat.
Well, I will let you guys both go. Thank you for doing this. Thanks for taking the time from the West Coast, both of you. And hopefully see you guys soon.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 139 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for a mailing list to get the updates on the most recent episodes, and at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can always contact us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website or emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do, so please give it. Both positive, negative, things you want to see in future episodes, and positive reviews are always welcome and appreciated in the iTunes Store or Android Store. Drs. Chow and Khan, thank you so much for joining me. Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, Angela Chang produced and publicized this great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis. The patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather signing off.
feeling.
This is straight from the